That's the great John Coltrane on tenor, opening up on My Shining Hour. Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. That was recorded on December the 2nd, 1959, years before, long before I was even born. This is Lead Stories, and that was a lead story. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, August the 28th, and a lot of ground to cover today. And in a hint, My Shining Hour suggests what our guests are about today. They're about to have their shining hour in the city of Ferguson. In the aftermath of the August 9th police killing of Michael Brown, Ferguson has become the epicenter of related political and social action. We are going to be talking today with a human rights activist and leader heading an initiative seeking to protect the citizens of Ferguson and, by extension, the citizens elsewhere in the United States who are engaged in lawful protest but find or believe their rights to be in jeopardy. Dr. Mustafa Ansari is Dean of the American Institute for Human Rights, and he is the point person on an initiative that we'll be talking about shortly. And he's going to be discussing human rights violations in Ferguson. Dr. Ansari trains the legal community in human rights law and practices and certifies human rights activists. The American Institute for Human Rights, of which he is dean, has engaged in many high-profile international human rights causes and cases. Dr. Ansari has worked on matters involving indigenous rights and the genocide in Bosnia. He's a member of the International Bar, and a great joy to have you with us today, Dr. Ansari.
Thank you very much for having me, Litchfield.
I wanted to ask about the is it your view that human rights violations have occurred in Ferguson?
For a long time. Human rights are violations of economic rights, political rights. And when we talk about civil and political rights, the civil and political rights of the citizens in Ferguson have been violated for 150, 200 years or so. And so what we see now is a lot of that festering that has exploded in this particular generation.
What is contemplated now in terms of human rights actions?
Well, we're considering a whole list of different things that we can do. Ferguson is an area with a majority population of African Americans, so they have a vehicle of direct democracy in which they can use to recall the mayor. And as you know, the mayor usually appoints the police chief, so that would solve two of their problems. And then they need to recall the city council and then replace them with the citizens and African-American citizens who are qualified to take those positions. Now, what we would like to do we'll discuss with them is how to govern, because Ferguson has been an example of bad governance. Good governance deals with how to deal with citizens and their police and police interaction, how to the criminal justice system, or how to treat offenders, how to arrest people, how to rehabilitate people, how to reconcile with the community so that when offenders are dealt with, mainly, especially when you talk about areas of when there's poverty, that we have a conduit in the criminal justice system for rehabilitation so that when these members are either released and for a lot of the members, we prefer non-custodial measures, If they, because that's a better way to reconcile them with the communities after being charged with an offense. So we would like. So what we would do would be to teach the new aspects, and we would like to teach police stations from around the country the minimum standards and how human rights and criminal justice. Are very much at odds. One is law and order. The human rights approach is one of compensation, justice, and reconcilement with the community. So there's a lot of things that need to be done in Ferguson as far as revamping the criminal justice system and the economic system and the political system.
But as far as the United Nations is concerned, under what authority are you asking the United Nations to become involved in the human rights violations of Ferguson?
Well, the United Nations has a superior court in San Jose, Costa Rica, the Inter-American Court, and that court is superior to any of the Supreme Courts in North America, Central America. Of South America, and under the Convention on Civil and Political Rights, and in the Convention on Torture and Degrading Treatment, and under the ICER, the International Convention on the Elimination of Racism, there's authority that the United States has signed those agreements, and so they have to abide by those agreements. We just not have as yet approached the international courts as we were directed and by Malcolm X way back in the 1964. So this is our first generation of international lawyers, our first understanding of how human rights and what the authority and our rights are under human rights. And what our recourses are. So yes, the international court has superior authority to deal with the human rights violations in any part of the Americas.
I don't mean to be a wet blanket here, but we both know that the United States does not recognize the international court. And even if you were to articulate a formal complaint to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, the United States has unquestionable power within the United Nations to counteract any affirmative action that you would take in terms of trying to see to the human rights protections of the citizens of Ferguson and, by extension, citizens of the United States who want to lawfully engage in basically their lives and just go along doing the things that are supposed to be done in a democratic society. Are you anticipating, do you have a fallback position when you file these complaints and you file this petition before the United Nations?
Well, we don't need a fallback position because the mainstream view, which you just articulated, is incorrect. Number one, the United States took exceptions only to the International Criminal Court. And one of our attorneys took out an arrest warrant for President Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Russell, the whole Iraq crew that was involved in rendition and the unlawful interventions into Iraq and Afghanistan. So as a result of that, there are outstanding warrants against all of them, and they are hampered in moving around the world. There's many countries that they cannot go to because of this thing called universal jurisdiction. So that's not quite correct. Secondly, any state that involves itself in racism, discrimination, apartheid, genocide, crimes against humanity are automatically under the auspices of the courts. Now, the courts are different than the United than the Security Council, in which the United States has veto power. The United States does not have veto power in the Inter-American Court and the Human Rights Council, they do not have veto power, which means that when we file a petition that and it's accepted by the international court, the United States has to respond. It has to respond. So it's incorrect to say that they do not abide by human rights decisions, and they have just a, so we don't really need a fallback position. Now, if they disagree with any of the rulings of the court in regards to our civil political rights, then that is a subject in which the United States would be ridiculed in the world, that they would have additional unrest from our people because of their blatant disregards for our civil and political rights and any decisions that have been made by a duly impaneled court.
That's great. I'm glad that you clarified that for me. I'm heavy about that. To your mind, what is the corollary for Ferguson in terms of where things are in the world today? What would you say Ferguson closely resembles?
Palestine. And many of our cities, we call it our Gaza, because many of our cities are occupied by a very hostile and militarized police force who have a us versus them type of attitude when we are supposed to be citizens. So when in Israel, the Zionists, and in their confrontation with the Palestinians, the true occupiers of the land, this is the best example or best corollary that I can think of is that we are under siege by a hostile military force.
What is the logistical process now as you put the petition together? What are the logistical elements of that?
Well, there is a lot of data coming into us from all around the country. In fact, we're holding up the petition for protection because we find that our citizens in Chicago need protection. They are being brutalized and killed by the police force there in New York, Eric Garner, and in Chicago there's many killings. And so we are gathering data and from different parts of the country right now. And so we are contemplating going on the offense against the police forces and their police associations and the United States, because they have acquiesced to this treatment of African Americans when they have a positive duty under these international conventions to prevent any harm to the citizens. So the United States and the states that have condoned and the cities that have condoned this treatment and this brutality and this militarization, we are going to hold them to answer by all means that we have necessary, by court actions in the state, city, federal, and the international courts, and by way of the political vehicles of recall, referendum, and succession, indigenous succession. So we are going to, the gloves are off. They're killing our children, so the gloves are off. So we're doing everything that we possibly can do to stop this right now so that our children and our grandchildren will not be further brutalized by this offensive, racist criminal justice system.
Well, certainly this is coming out of the African-American community. What so far have you gotten in terms of support or even expressed concern from outside of the African-American community?
Well, the whole world supports us. The whole world supports us. There's fantastic support from the United Nations. They are waiting for our petition. They have made inquiries. We just had our lawyers in Geneva meeting with the United Nations in regards to the Convention on the Elimination of Racism, in which we drilled the United States on the instances of racism, and Ferguson was at the top of the list, and the brutalization of the militarized police force. So we have gotten tremendous support from Geneva, from outside, all the law-abiding states in which the United States have hypocritically claimed to be a democratic country that protects its citizens is being exposed. And so we are getting tremendous support from all of the states. And remember, it's the states who are the judges in the various courts. Sometimes there's 15 judges who make decisions. Sometimes it's 8 judges, depending on which court or which forum we take them to. These judges are not from the United States. These judges are from these nations that understand the human rights law and understand the duties that the United States is supposed to abide by and their protection of the citizens. So there's tremendous support outside of this country that we don't get inside the country, especially from the Congress and those racist pinheads and the Supreme Court. So our support is actually from our communities, from the good law-abiding people of the United States that understand this trauma and this 200-year trauma, and the outside states. So it's tremendous support from the outside states.
Well, Dr. Ansari, I've got to tell you, I think I chose the right selection today. Your shining hour has come, and I'm looking forward to following up on how this is unfolding, and we will keep tabs on the progress that you're making in filing this United Nations petition for protection of citizens in the United States.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. I just want to ask you one more thing. How can people help you?
Well, let us know. Inform us, and we are putting together a hotline on any type of these police brutalities. And we are opening up a clinic for intake. So there will be ways to help volunteer, donate at probably in about 30 to 60 days as we start putting up the infrastructures of this criminal human rights defense structure.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, we've talked about how important it is that people understand that the battle is legal. The battle is in the court. And all of that energy, you know, being devoted to other things is a kind of distraction in a way, because it is not backing up a fight, and it is not in and of itself a fight. So it is very, very very heartening that this is the direction that is being taken, because it is long overdue. The newly formed Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition is leading a national march on Ferguson this Saturday, aimed at galvanizing the unharnessed social and political power of youth and channeling it toward actions and solutions to the myriad problems confronting this demographic. So we are about to get an insider's view of the aims and objectives of this march on Saturday, and more importantly, the targets of its directed action. Joining us is Ya Ami, who was first with us when things were pretty rough, with all that tear gassing and rubber bullets flying around in Ferguson. He's a human rights activist with the Human Rights and Justice Committee in Ferguson. And Yah Ami, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's always great to be on the show. Thank you.
Okay. Could you tell us what's going on with this march and what you hope? You are among a coalition, a very broad coalition. Tell us what the coalition is attempting to accomplish by staging this political rally, and it seems to be very youth-focused.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I am representing the Human Rights and Justice Committee of Missouri in conjunction with Justice for Mike Brown Leadership Coalition. We are collaborating, and we have put on this, we're putting on this march for Saturday. And I will say that it is very youth oriented. It's important that we hear the voices of our youth. We need to know what their goals are, what their objectives are, and how we can make that become a reality for them. Oftentimes, our youth are left behind, and it's the same leaders every year, talking about some of these other issues and not really involving the youth. So it's time for a change. And so we, as a collective body, are listening to our youth. We are addressing some of the concerns that our youth have. Some of it includes boycotting. Some of it includes the march that we're doing on Saturday. So there's a few specifics that we are channeling our agendas now and our focal point. We want to drive home that collectively what we are doing is Human Rights and Justice Committee. We are strategizing. We will be conducting training classes, and we will be doing voter registration. We are putting that together now as we speak, getting a team together to hit the street door to door, campaigning, canvassing, and getting people registered to vote. That's a priority. Okay, that's a number one priority. Okay, in addition to that, we still have some unfinished business to attend with the city council and the mayor, the chief of police, an officer that executed Mike Brown, and now the officer that executed Powell. Kimmy Powell. Correct. Yeah. So we have some unfinished business to do. And one, you heard the terminology. We need to police the police. Well, that's correct. We need to. We are in a process of creating a vigilance committee to police the police. To monitor them, their actions, especially when it relates to them being in our community. We are also demanding that since approximately 67% of the population in Ferguson, Missouri is predominantly black, we are demanding that the police force also be mostly black. We understand that in these environments where the percentile is of that race of people should be represented in the police force, as well as the city council, as well as the government agencies, the government entities. And so these are just some simple methods that we are demanding, and that we will have this justice in these areas. We will appoint someone on the council, an entire council of the people, for the people, and by the people, as well as the police chief. The police chief will be terminated. These are things that we are pushing forward. It's enough of us collective bodies to make this happen. It's enough of us collective bodies to have that mayor removed, to have the governor removed, and we will, as a people, push forward until that is done. We will, as a people, push forward to have the officer terminated that executed Mike Brown and the officers that also executed Powell several days later. As a result of, well, in the midst of us protesting and covering the footage and the story of Mike Brown. So there are a few areas, Utrecht, that we are certainly heading in the direction in, and some of which we have already begun doing, like on the groundwork. We've already begun having a team of crew from the Human Rights and Justice Committee door knocking, asking what are your concerns, what are your needs, food, medicine, groceries, clothing, because, again, it is still a martial law state. They're still implementing martial law.
Thank you for giving us an overview. We're joined now by Akbar Muhammad. He's an associate professor of history and Africana studies at Binghamton University in New York. He also serves as the international representative of Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Professor Muhammad, thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. First, I want to just make a correction, because whenever you Google me or go to get my background offline, they confuse me most of the time with Dr. Akbar Muhammad at Binghamton University. He is a brother, the youngest son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, with his mother Clara Muhammad, and he is a professor who studied in Cairo, Egypt. That is not me. That's why mine is always A. Akbar Muhammad, but I appreciate that. I was up in Binghamton a little while back, and we were at the same mosque praying, and so we had a joke. I get your calls, and he gets my calls, you know, people looking for both of us. So I identify myself as A. Akbar Muhammad, International Representative for Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. But thank you anyway.
I thank you for the correction. Done very nicely. I feel very, very, I don't feel the slightest bit bruised. I'm very happy about that. Could you talk about what is your concern in Ferguson, and why will you be there on Saturday?
Well, my concern on Ferguson, and it's a historical overview, and this month is really an important month. The month of August, the 28th, matter of fact, today is the anniversary of the historical Million Man March, where Dr. King, even though he didn't exactly lead the march, but he was instrumental in it, and he made his famous speech, I Have a Dream, August the 28th, 1963. Also, I believe this same day, in 1955, Emmett Till was killed. On the 27th, which was yesterday, we lost one of the finest minds that we produced in the black communities of America, W.E.B. Du Bois, who died in Ghana in West Africa. But it's a historical period, and I want to say that what we want to do in Ferguson on Saturday, August the 30th, from 10 to 5 p.m., is that we want to make a statement that this movement must not die, that this is something that was thrust on us, the young people, who, as my brother before me talked about, are very important in this equation, and I would hope that they would appreciate the lessons learned from history. And that it was young people with Martin Luther King. There's three books written by Taylor Branch. And at this period, that we should go and review them. It was a man named Reverend James Bevel who suggested to Dr. Martin Luther King that we get the young people involved, get them into the streets. And we never wanted to see the dogs in the holes and the beating by the police in Alabama when the young people took to the streets, but it made an impact. It impacted the entire world. The young people in South Africa during their struggle against a racist apartheid regime, it was the young people who turned out in the street and turned the movement in the direction that eventually led to South Africa gaining its freedom and Nelson Mandela becoming the first black president of that great nation. So young people are important. Michael Brown was a young black American, and by being shot down viciously by a white police officer, and the reaction of young people is what started this movement that we have right now. Reverend Al Sharpton said it the best. He said, we must turn this moment into a movement. And the movement is against the historically racist policemen who have this attitude towards young black men in this country. And when it first started out the second night, they caught on tape one of the police officers calling us animals. And if they see you as an animal that's in their way or is a problem for them, you shoot an animal. And that's what has been happening to our people. The USA Today, in one of the headlines during this crisis, said that last year, 400 young black men and some women were shot down by police across America. So this is going on throughout the country, but their focus on it has been limited, because if the young people that night had not reacted, this would have been the killing of a young black man who they accused of trying to take the policeman's gun and punching him in the eye, and the police was trying to defend his life, and he shot him down. And in 2 weeks, we would have buried him, and it would have been history. He would have been another statistic. But the young people reacted, and they reacted in such a way that it caught the attention of the St. Louis community, and then when it hit national news, it caught the attention of the news, and it went on. And then the police overreacted. Their overreaction brought the attention of the world when they brought out military equipment and the armament that most people in America had no idea that cities across America were armed with this by the federal government and were receiving this kind of equipment free, and they turned it out in the street. It was overwhelming, and the press was there to capture it, and it went out to the world, and it started what you see today. So I agree with my brother who was on before me that there must be action plans. Some people call in and say, we don't need to be marching. We need to be doing this. We need to hit them in the pocketbook. We need to demonstrate, or not demonstrate, but do boycotts against stores. But if you don't have those who are marching and make sure that the boycotts and whatever you have in mind are carried out, then you have nothing. Look how long the Montgomery boycott lasted. I believe it was over 400 days.
Yes, it was.
That it lasted a little over a year, but they were persistent, and they kept going until they had complete victory. And on this particular proposition, we must keep going. So our march on Saturday, we have called the entire country and different communities. If they can't come, then demonstrate that day and lift up your voice that we will not tolerate the killing of our people by racist policemen who patrol the streets of America, that police brutality must stop. And then we must get rid of the culture within the police departments across this country of cover-up. There's a culture of cover-up. When they make mistakes or do things that are obviously wrong and clearly wrong, then we must stop the practice of covering up what the police do and persecute them for crimes that they commit against citizens. This is what it's about. So that's why I'm encouraging the people who can make it, those cities around St. Louis and those who can make it nationally, to be with us in great numbers so that we can lift up our voices and change this reality across America.
Well, I thank you for that. One question to you, Yaami. I look at the participants, and also Minister Muhammad, I look at the participants who, the major participants of this coalition, and it is a stark observation that we don't see representation of the so-called political establishment. Is there a reason?
No, we have state representatives. We have local councilmen. Unfortunately, we don't have any mayors that have joined us on the coalition. But remember, across the country, and you watch the news said that there was no leadership in St. Louis. Hmm. And they accused us of no leadership. The young people who want to do something have no guidance. So we put this together. You know, we didn't have a manual sitting on a shelf. So if the policemen shoot down or murder a young black man in the street, and this is what you should do, and pull that manual off the shelf and walk through the steps and the procedures, we didn't have that. We had to think on our feet. We had to be creative. We had to say to whosoever will, let him come. And that's how we form this leadership coalition. And there are people who are willing to join the coalition now, but they don't know exactly how to get in it. We're reaching out for them, and we want to make it possible for all that want to join the coalition who have organizations that they represent, that they be a part of it.
Great. Yami?
Yes, I certainly concur, Big Brother. Thank you so much, Muhammad. Yeah, I certainly concur. Again, you know, we've reached out to several political leaders, and again, as the Big Brother just said, a lot of them kind of declined, and they made the statements that we have no leadership. So we are the leadership. We as a governing body, will lead this this march on the 30th, and we will continue to move forward.
Well, I want to thank you both for bringing us up to snuff here today. I certainly would be monitoring how it goes. I'm not in St. Louis, and I can't be there on Saturday.
You're here with
But my spirit is there with you, and this is an extraordinary moment. We opened the show today with John Coltrane's My Shining Hour, and I hope this, too, will be your shining hour on Saturday. Thank you so much, Minister A. Akbar Muhammad, not the Associate Professor of History at Binghamton. And thank you, Ya Ami, for being with us today on Lead Stories. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. We'll take a break and come back and discuss why Minister Alfred Sharpton is not likely to get that special prosecutor. He hasn't asked for it, but he's not likely to get it if he does. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And the New York Times editorial board, at a stinging rebuke of Governor Andrew Cuomo on Tuesday, explained that it will not be endorse him for election in the September 9th primary in New York because he has failed at his number one job. And that number one job, which he himself had identified as the reason for his running in the first place, for his first term, was cleaning up corruption in state government. Well, according to the New York Times editorial board, he has not done that job. In fact, he is part of the problem himself of corruption. He says, they said in the editorial, the state government remains as subservient to big money as ever, and Mr. Cuomo resisted and even shut down opportunities to fix it. Because he broke his most important promise, we have decided not to make an endorsement for the Democratic primary September 9. Well, that was kind of rough. In the way of politics and in the way of the New York Times, making a point of not endorsing somebody. And what they did by writing such an editorial and taking such a position is that they basically associated Governor Cuomo with corruption and said that there's undue influence of big money in the state government and in his administration. And even when he appointed a commission to look into the problem, when the commission started getting close to people who were close to him, he shut it down. And that's the reason now a federal prosecutor is looking into that. But what is interesting about all of this is that, you know, Cuomo will probably, the polls are saying that he would probably prevail in the election on September the 9th. He's doing very well in the polls. And frankly, there's really not much of an opposition. So it might be a cakewalk for him in the September 9th primary. Now, why this is significant is that the New York Times is saying the governor and his administration are way too closely identified with corruption. And this is why Governor Cuomo has to lean even more heavily on the African American community, because votes are important. White voters who are likely to be alienated by this association of corruption and the governor, or just generally not pleased with his performance, and who may choose not to vote or may choose not to vote for him, well, they have, those numbers have to be made up for. And you go, of course, the traditional place where the Democratic Party always goes. It goes to the African-American community, because those are predictable numbers. And who are the people who are sent to mine the vote? Yes, those people who go to the churches and conduct the Souls to the Polls program, and Alfred Sharpton is one of them. Now, don't forget, Alfred Sharpton is now very nicely situated. He has made himself very necessary to the Democratic Party, and this has boosted his currency in the political world with the Democrats, because he has greater influence now than he ever had, even all the way up to the president. In some ways, one could say that he is Obama's emissary to the black community, because he's the king of all blacks. So when you want to talk to black people, you send the emissary. Go talk to them. But here's the thing. Cuomo, nonetheless, is on edge. He's not as solid in his political position as he would have liked to be, because this association with corruption and this New York Times editorial slamming him the way that it did gives ammunition to perhaps a very strong Republican challenger. And Cuomo doesn't need right now to ruffle anybody's feathers, because he just can't weaken his political position. To appoint a special prosecutor, he will necessarily weaken his political position. Why? Because he will have to instruct a fellow Democrat, the Attorney General, to ruffle feathers. And the feathers that the Attorney General will have to ruffle belong to the District Attorney, another Democrat. So he's going to have to do damage to fellow Democrats, because he will have to instruct the Attorney General to remove the District Attorney handling the Eric Garner chokehold case and replace that District Attorney with a special prosecutor. This is never, ever a popular move. And because he is in a politically precarious position, he is not at all likely to take on another set of headaches by having people within the party now really unhappy with him. And that is why Al Sharpton will not ask for a special prosecutor, because his fidelity is to the political party. And the political party, the highest official really in the state, is the governor, and he has pledged his troth to the governor. which is, of course, part of the whole thing about corruption in the first place. But that with that allegiance is tight. And so Al Sharpton is not about to compromise his personal bennies that he gets by having these allegiances with Governor Cuomo at the state level and Barack Obama at the federal level. You see how this all works? He is not about to disrupt a good thing that he's enjoying. And he will disrupt it if he insists on the appointment of a special prosecutor. And he understands implicitly that he can't go there. He can't cross that line because he will lose. He would lose a lot. And this is more important to Al Sharpton at this point than the justice that he's clamoring for and having people in the street screaming about wanting justice. And as I said, I think it's a great idea that people are motivated, and they are motivated by the most precious of motivations. They really feel about this case, but they are being manipulated. And these are the political considerations. So in a strange way, the New York Times actually produces proof of what it is I have been saying. When the governor is so compromised, and he is, by corruption, by the influence of big money in his government, by the fact that people can pretty much write a check and get exactly what they want, by creating the not just the perception, but the reality that Albany, the state capital, is, as they say, licensed fraud. You can get whatever you want out of the Cuomo administration if you have enough money. And lobbyists are descending on Cuomo like crazy, which is why, by the way, and this is a very interesting contradiction, this governor cut more than $1.5 billion from public education. And he is a flagrant cheerleader for the charter school system. He's out there saying charter schools are great and backing the corporate charter school movement, giving it incredible license to do whatever it wants in the state of New York, all of which, of course, is predicated on one single idea, that Black and Latino communities are the mining grounds for the profitability of these systems. But that doesn't bother Al Sharpton. This is just really not, this is a technicality. But the New York Times did note that he did cut that kind of money, that huge, hefty sum from the public school budget, which should worry every person of color in a leadership position. So there you go. Just to line it up again, I've been telling you this is not going to happen. You cannot expect Al Sharpton to call for a special prosecutor because there is too much riding on it. And yet, It is an essential element in justice for Eric Garner. Why? Because the culture of Staten Island is such that it is heavily favoring the police, heavily anti-people of color. It already has shown that it has taken a path. We talked about this claim by the district attorney of impaneling a special grand jury, which is routinely not about indicting people. It is about issuing reports for legislative reform and how that links to the homicide of a citizen. One can only surmise that in the mind of the district attorney, this is a procedural matter. This is an administrative review. This is not about the fact that a person is dead on the sidewalk, dead by police chokehold. So political considerations have trumped justice. When the people really need the assurance that their leadership is in tune with this clamor for justice and the investment that they're making, supposedly in their minds, to assure and guarantee justice. We have these cozy relationships, and these cozy relationships, literally born in the crucible of corruption, are the things that prevail, and the rights of the people, well, they come a second, sometimes a very distant second. But there is no intention by Al Sharpton to disrupt his private relationships and benefits that he gains from the relationships that he has with President Obama at the national level, and the son Andrew Cuomo at the state level. And Cuomo, in turn, has no interest in weakening his already rattled political position within the Democratic Party as its titular head in the state of New York by removing fellow Democrats in order to put in a system that would make the people happy and give them some degree of trust in the system. That is not a high priority item. What's more important is that he maintains the political status quo and the relationships he has with his fellow Democrats. So the trade-offs all the way around are about, well, our relationships and our concerns, meaning Cuomo's and Sharpton's, they take precedence over this thing that you people want, and you're annoying us with these cries for justice. You will get justice by going through the system as it exists, and we will give you all of our, you know, we'll recite all the things that we typically say about, you know, transparency, and we too are interested in justice. But special prosecutor, forget that. It's not going to happen. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was instructive. It certainly is a cheerful way to come, you know, toward the end of the week, understanding that there are people who see the need to move around the existing leadership that has become an impediment to progress, and they are assuming the responsibility of moving forward. And that is an extraordinarily positive development. I really am thrilled about the progress report that we got today coming out of Ferguson. And, of course, we'll be following up on the progress that they're making in their various initiatives. But this is great stuff. And it would be good if people can support that, even if you just in your heart say, well, this is a good thing. This is the way it ought to be. And it's unfortunate, as we're hearing, 200-plus years have passed, and we have a supposedly African-American administration where the two top people, the president and his attorney general, are in a position to create changes. And people were, you know, kind of reluctant to do things because they didn't want to embarrass them, see. But now, as Dr. Ansari said, the gloves are off. And I think that's a splendid attitude. Tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday, and you are at the helm. You take the conversation wherever it is you want it to go. Please keep it here at PRN.FM. Occupied Territory, America is next with Mike Fader. And I really do enjoy getting your feedback at leadstories@gmail.com. And on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I'm going to be, as of next week, I'm going to begin a special series of programs. I want to get this program far more well-circulated. So far, incredible reaction to it. And I don't take this as a personal thing. I think it is a combination of everybody's effort that makes the program appealing. and people find it useful, and it helps them understand the world a bit better. So I want to get the more aggressive about getting the program out there, and I would be soliciting your help in that regard. I do thank you so much for joining me here every day, and for, in your own way, helping to promote the program. I see so many of you passing the word along to your friends and those in your circle. I thank you for that. And I want to encourage us to come together more often and to spread the word that PRN.FM, and certainly your very favorite program, Lead Stories on PRN, these are two musts in your everyday life. So, as always, thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company, and I hope this program was useful to you today. Bye-bye.